From the Hope 205 Studios, a Joe Louville Productions studio venture.
Imagine a workplace where leaders focus on empowering their teams, where the growth and well-being of people are at the heart of every decision. This isn't a distant dream. This is Activating Hope.
Colbert is an accomplished author, speaker, and marketing strategist with deep expertise in higher education, healthcare, and professional services. As the founder of Silvertree Communications and Silvertree Market Research, she helps organizations uncover their meaningful difference and stand out in competitive markets. Kate combines data-driven strategy with powerful storytelling to guide leaders in shaping compelling brand narratives that drive real results. With graduate degrees in both literature and business, Kate is the author of Think Like a Marketer and Commencement, and her insights have been featured in Forbes, NPR, and Harvard Business Review. She now advises top universities and Fortune 500 companies on communication, leadership, and how to succeed by being meaningfully different. I want to welcome Kate to this episode of Activating Hope. And Kate, I have to tell you, I'm so excited to have you on a guest for the second season because I have worked with you in a capacity of editing and publishing, and you were instrumental in helping us get Hope for Leaders in the 2020s across the finish line in 2022. And you've helped my husband get his across the finish line numerous times. And so you are fabulous at the editing and publishing, but we were talking about you being a possible guest and the other things that you could share with our listeners. You started talking about this whole concept of bad bosses. And I want to tell you, I was immediately intrigued and then also immediately having PTSD by some of the bad bosses that I have worked for, the horrible bosses I've worked for through the years in my corporate career, and even sometimes working with clients on the consulting side, but not necessarily a boss, but somebody with a very, very strong personality. So I just, I want to say welcome to this episode.
Well, thanks so much for having me. This is going to be fun.
You are welcome. Well, you know, let's just dive in. I'm just out of curiosity because I guess horrible boss can mean different things to different people.
Yep.
But, you know, when you talk about horrible boss, you know, what does that look like? And how is that different from when someone calls you a managerial terrorist? Because I've heard that too. So like, you know, which is worse, being a mad boss, bad boss, or managerial terrorist?
Yeah. The terrorists are the worst, right? But, you know, I think bad bosses are everywhere. And I've been a bad boss. You've probably been a bad boss, especially early in our careers when we were learning. And, you know, we thought we were supposed to be really tough, right? I used to be the kind of person who read books, you know, titled things like, nice girls don't get the corner office, like that kind of, like where, and I used to say things like that too, right? Like, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to get worked out. Like, And so I think we've all sort of been bad bosses and we've seen bad bosses, but I think that people being lacking in a few places at work. So maybe your boss isn't warm and fuzzy and they don't know how to handle things without being awkward when personal stuff comes up. Maybe somebody's crying at work and they don't know what to do with that. Or maybe they forget to give enough sort of atta girls or atta boys to their team. That's not uncommon. And while I think that it can be really deflating or demotivating to have a boss who's mediocre at their job, a bad boss is not the same thing as a horrible boss. You know, when I talk about managerial terrorists, I'm talking about like those supervisory sadists who seem to go out of their way to torment their employees. Those people who are actively cruel, dismissive, petty, cold, unpredictable, inappropriate, and even abusive. And sadly, there are people like this in every industry and in almost every workplace.
So would you say then, Kate, that that is on the hierarchy of bad bosses? That's the highest.
That's as bad as it gets.
As bad as it gets. Okay. I'm just trying to, think about, you've got, like you said, your bad ones that are occasionally forget to do some things. They're just not great. But then you climb up that hierarchy and it gets really bad.
It gets bad. Yeah. It gets bad. And I think it's important. I love that you invited me on to talk about this today, because I think that we have a tendency when we're talking to our friends or family or colleagues and people are like, oh my God, you won't believe what my boss did to me. And a lot of people who've had sort of bad or mediocre bosses might sort of pish-posh that and be like, whatever, suck it up. You know, it's ever, we all have bad bosses. But there are people like me and maybe like you and like lots of people who are listening to this podcast who have actually been sort of verbally abused or really, really taken advantage of in the workplace in a way that is not something that we should have to, quote unquote, suck it up. And I think that we need to be talking about what that looks like and talking about that this is still happening, even in a modern world with HR and with all kinds of laws in place. And so I thought it would be important for us to talk about that today. So thanks.
Well, and I do want to ask a follow-up question to that. Do you think you've seen or you've heard of more managerial terrorists, like so up to the highest of the hierarchy, post-COVID?
No, that's a really great question. So no, I think that back when we were more held hostage physically in, you know, going to workplaces where people expected you to be there at, you know, 8 a.m. in fancy business clothes with hair and makeup or shine shoes or whatever the case may be. And people could come barging into your office and yell at you or call you and say, get to the boss's office now. I think that that kind of face-to-face sort of corporate sort of brick and mortar workplace is more of a breeding ground for these kinds of horrible bosses. I think that when you're in a meeting and somebody is behaving horribly towards you, and you're sitting safely at your home office, there is some protection in that. And when you can log off of a meeting and leave a meeting, there is some protection in that. But it's very different to be in a conference room with someone who's screaming at you and decide whether you're going to stand up and walk out.
Exactly.
And that's really different. And so I think that some of the changes we've seen in the workplace and some of the humanity, right? So even people who did wear double-breasted suits to work and whatever else, during the pandemic, they were showing up on Zoom wearing a sweater or a t-shirt. And I think that some of that sort of power distance that often happens between employees and their bosses, I think a lot of that got minimized during the pandemic. And hopefully for a lot of organizations and industries, the lessons we learned from the pandemic have stuck around and some of those cultural things have changed. And so I'm actually hearing fewer horrible boss stories now than I did, you know, 5-10 years ago.
That's very encouraging. Because if I feel, you know, psychologically, there's no safety in that moment, I'm on Zoom, I just hit leave meeting.
Yep, exactly.
It's like, bye-bye, I'm gone. I'm gone. So that is very encouraging. And I think that companies are investing more. I'm seeing that on the leadership development side, in leadership development post-COVID, because workers aren't as tolerant of these bad bosses, managerial terrorists that we're talking about.
Yep.
I mean, if they're not feeling good about where they're working, they have no problem leaving the meeting.
Well, that's exactly it, because we're all survivors, Hope, right? Like, we all literally lived through, you know, a global pandemic that killed 1 million people in the United States alone. So we've seen the worst of life and of work and of health and public health. And so some people were able to sort of battle test this and figure out if they were used to having two incomes in their house and they had kids to take care of. Maybe somebody lost their job during the pandemic and they figured out how to downsize and how to pay the bills on one. And so suddenly I think there's just a lot of people who are saying, I don't have to put up with what I used to put up with. Like I've been able to prove it to myself that I'm really resilient and that there is hope and that there is a different future than the way that we used to work. And so, yeah, I always say never waste a crisis. And I think that in leadership, there were so many lessons from the pandemic, just like there are lessons from working for a really bad boss. And I hope that people are applying them better. But I'm thrilled to hear that you're seeing a lot more organizations investing in that kind of leadership.
It's very encouraging that some don't want to be as bad.
Yeah.
That will say that. So speaking of that, I would love to hear about your horrible boss stories, you know, and paint a picture of what it was like to go to work for leaders each day, you know, in your career with that. And as you said, I can completely attest to it too. There would be days I would sit in my car crying because I did not want to walk into the office because I knew what was going to come. There were no surprises. You know, I could be disappointed, but I was not surprised by the micromanagement, the disrespect I felt of, you know, just comments and of things like that. And I can't tell you that I responded to that well. And I love what you said about, you know, using those crisis moments as opportunities. I can't tell you in my early 30s when I first got into management, worked for bad bosses, that I use those as opportunities. It was just like, right. why is this happening to me?
Right. Neither did I. You know, I mean, hindsight is always 20/20, and I've learned a lot from what I've been through, but I don't, you know, and I think we can talk about that too, is like, what did I get right? And what did I get wrong? But there were a lot of things. So in terms of what happened to me, you know, I've had a lot of bad bosses, but there are two that really created the most emotional scars, Michael and Peter. And for the people who are listening and are wondering, is she making up fake names? No. And here's why. Here's one of the things I have learned is, you know, in life, if you would like people to speak better of you, you should have behaved better, right? And I do not anymore carry any of the shame from what was done to me by horrible bosses. And so, you know, so if people want to figure out who these guys are by looking at my LinkedIn profile, go for it, right? Because, you know, the truth is the truth. And the beautiful thing I know as a writer who often writes true stories is that, you know, the truth is a absolute defense against libel in the United States. So my first really horrible boss was a physician. He was a university president. I worked at a medical sciences university. He literally described himself as, quote, a bit of a tyrant when he was interviewing people. He like thought that wore it like as a badge of honor. And he did a lot of shouting. He went out of his way to humiliate people in meetings. And he often summoned me to his office by calling my boss or my administrative assistant and would like scream, I need her in my office now. And I would literally run from my side of the campus over to the president's office, like in high heels, like running on my tiptoes, you know, being beckoned. One time with a sprained ankle, actually, he was my boss's boss. And when he said jump, she basically said how high, and she really cracked sort of the proverbial whip. And so she never protected me. So he was essentially sort of my boss. He tortured me. Michael tortured me daily for years. But two moments I would say have really haunted me the most and for decades. Moment number one, our institution was in the middle of a big scandal, two scandals actually. Our board of trustees had just embezzled $1 million from us and we had just been notified by the FBI. And our medical school had just been put on probation by its accreditors. We were about to walk across the stage at commencement and hand MD degrees and PhD degrees to all these students from a medical institution that was about to go on probation. And we needed to figure out how to talk about this to the media. So we were planning a press conference to tell everyone what was going on. Long story short, he was about to make a really huge mistake. He wanted to be able to spend some time in the morning telling our faculty and our staff about what was going on. All this was a secret at this point. I was the head of communications, so I was in the know about everything always. And he was going to try to get a bunch of stuff done on campus, then drive to downtown Chicago. We were in the northern suburbs of Chicago, and then do this press conference. And he wanted to do the press conference at about 2:00 in the afternoon. But this was back in the day when not every media outlet even had sort of an ability to publish their articles on a website. You had to wait for the magazine. You had to wait for the newspaper. And he wanted to do the press conference at 2:00 PM when a lot of reporters had a filing deadline of 3 PM, meaning they would come to our press conference and there was not going to be time for them to get back to the office, write up the story and get it in tomorrow's paper. So they were going to get scooped. All of those, the Chicago Tribune, et cetera, were going to get scooped by the few people who know how to get a story online. And I kept saying, we can't do this. We need to do this at like 11 in the morning. We had board members, but all these things going on, all these people, you know, lawyers and whatnot on a conference call. And we were in a conference room together and he kept talking over me. And I kept raising my hand, sir, like I was a media relations expert. I was the head of marketing and communications and he kept talking over me. And eventually I interrupted and I said, with all due respect, sir, you do not want to piss off people who buy ink by the barrel. And the room went quiet. And he turned and he looked at me and he took a deep breath and he screamed, all right, I hear you. The next week, I was demoted. I lost all my staff, and I was moved out of my big, beautiful corner office into a tiny closet that was painted black. It had used to be the dark room where film was developed. It didn't have a window, and it didn't have room for a desk. So I had to sit a little counter. For good measure, they gave all of my former staff really posh offices across the hall from me. And they made me report to a sleazeball who liked to ask me about my sex life.
Wow.
So that was sort of moment number one. Moment number two with Michael.
And by the way, I would have been gone after moment number one.
Right. But here's the thing. I was 28 years old. Oh. I was single.
You needed the job.
I had fantastic benefits and I had an apartment to pay for and a car payment, and I would have been homeless. Like I had no idea what I was going to do if I lost this job. So, and I think they knew that. Moment number two was the day that the president literally got in my face and was screaming at me, "What were you thinking?" I got poorly quoted in Crane's Chicago Business. I said something to a reporter that was taken out of context, got quoted poorly. I could feel the spit hitting my face. He was standing that close to me, screaming at me in my face. And I knew that if I took a step backward, I was going to get fired. And so I stood there and I took it.
And he knew you would. I mean, that's the power.
He knew he would. This was, you know, he was really prone to bring, you know, young women like me into his office and torment us this way. You know, and hey, moment number three, I was burning a really high fever. One day I had caught an infection. So I had pleurisy. I had an infection in the lining of my lungs. And if anybody's listening has ever had pleurisy, they know it's miserable. So I could barely breathe and I was burning a fever, and he had me in his office writing a press release about something. And then he asked me this. Now remember, this guy's a physician. And he said, how are you feeling? And I said, not so great, sir. Thanks for asking. And then he told me to go home and get some rest. And I said, thank you. And I said, I'll get this finished for you tomorrow or the next day, or, you know, by the end of the week. And I went and told my boss I was leaving, and I packed up my stuff and I went home and I was and crawled into bed. He promptly marched into my boss's office and asked, and I quote, "Does she have the stamina for this job?" Because I was sick, because I was unlucky enough to like breathe in when somebody coughed on me, right?
Well, and you so thought you were having a moment with him when he was like, "Just go home, get some rest."
Home.
Like,
I thought, "Oh my God, he's being a human."
He's being like, "Here's his empathy. It has actually shown up. Yes,
right,
I'm feeling
right,
better."
Bedside manner, but it turns out no. So the next day, when I came back to the office, still very sick and still burning a fever, but not feeling like I could take a whole day off of work, my boss came and yelled at me and she said, "Don't you ever make me have to defend you like that to my boss." So instead of protecting me and saying, "Hey, she was sick," she went ahead and let him create this narrative in his mind.
She defended his narrative.
Yeah, that me getting sick somehow said something about my competence and my character, my commitment to my job, which of course it said none. And then there was the other sort of managerial terrorist, Peter. This was a boss who used to walk into my office and grab a stapler off my desk. I'm actually grabbing one right now to relive the moment.
You're reacting.
So you know how like a stapler, like a swing line stapler, like you could open it up flat so that you could like staple a poster onto a wall. So he would open up the stapler like that and he would walk up to me and he would say things like, "Tell me the report is finished or I'm going to put a staple in your neck." He also frequently would say, "Don't make me push you down a flight of stairs." And he called one of my female employees Legs because she was tall and she was young. And he used to stand all 6'5" of him with this big booming voice in my cubicle door, refusing to leave and refusing to let me out. And he would just sort of like tower over me at my desk. And if I stood up, then he acted like that was some sort of an offense. He also would like, if you were sitting at his desk, he would get upset about stuff and he would like slam his hands down on the desk and like kind of come forward at you. I used to jump back. Like I thought I was going to get physically harmed at some point. He frequently threatened to throat punch me. He would be like, "Oh, come on. Don't screw that up. Like, don't make me throat punch you. Ha ha ha."
Well, and at what moment? I mean, I would just imagine as a young person, and I don't know when you worked with Peter, you were older. This was after
Michael.
Yeah,
I was in my 30s.
You were in your 30s. But, were there moments that you just thought, who can I go tell? Because this is a toxic work environment. This is harassment.
Yeah. Now, incidentally, so this was at another higher education institution. I was at a graduate business school heading up the marketing as director of marketing. And I had had a wonderful boss before Peter, amazing boss, who left to go be a leadership coach. And we had formerly had a wonderful VP of HR who never, ever, ever would have tolerated this. But she also left to go start her own coaching practice. And they brought in a new HR person who had no experience in HR, none. And she was a VP. And she thought Peter was funny. And she wasn't afraid of him because she was his peer. He couldn't fire her. And she didn't have to answer to him. And so she wasn't afraid. And so in the end, I resigned. I blew the whistle in a 3-hour exit interview. And I was told by the head of HR, but he was just kidding. So I had to remind her what hostile workplace is by law and how that works. Ultimately, 6 employees reported him to HR. We all left. And it took them 2 more years before they finally fired him. When they did, they had him escorted out by the police because lo and behold, I was telling the truth when I talked to them about his anger issues and his propensity for violence.
Well, there's validation when truth triumphs, because yes. In our world today, it's one person's story against another person's story. And, you know, what I always say to leaders is if someone says they've made you feel unsafe, you've made them feel unsafe, that is their story.
Yeah, that's true.
So even if you say that was not my intent, I was just, you know, and I'm air quoting here, joking.
Right. Just joking.
You don't joke like that today.
Right.
I mean, and create that. But it is unfortunate sometimes how long it takes to get this type of toxicness out of an organization. Because a lot of times people are afraid to speak up, or if they do speak up, they don't get supported. Because, right. You know, we all know it's very political and, you know, you may have somebody that's like, oh, I'm not going against him.
Right.
And then what gets rewarded gets repeated.
Yep.
And then these people just gain more power because they have been validated that they can do this and nothing has happened. So the accountability there isn't, because there's no consequence for these type of horrible actions.
Yeah. What I tried to do really hard, I mean, I've healed from it over the years in a way that I was unable to in the moment. But even when I was in these situations, I realized that other people were being treated badly. It wasn't just me. And I did everything that I could with the skills that I had to help other people. So when I worked at the medical university, I used to teach a women's communications seminar for women at all levels of the university called Girl Talk. And I would teach women why they should not apologize if they didn't do anything wrong, and how to really sort of hold their own against sort of fragile male egos and all this kind of stuff. And I did my best to try to help people and to protect my staff too. And so, looking back, but you're absolutely right. The validation. I mean, listen, somebody inside Peter's organization picked up the phone and called me the day that he was escorted out by the police. I mean, I heard about it immediately because people knew what I had endured and what I had survived. And they knew that there would be some amount of validation in me knowing how it ended. My only regret really on that one was that I didn't get the other 5 people who all quit to go to my lawyer's office together to file a class action lawsuit, because we would have won.
Well, and you know, in one of my traumatic experiences where the best worst thing this guy ever said to me is when I finished my doctorate, he's like, "This is so awesome that someday you might get promoted over a man because you'll have your doctoral degree." And I never, ever forgot that. I was like, okay, wow. I'm pretty sure that's not right. And it went on to get worse, 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 until finally, like you, I stayed on for about 2 years, but I also had my goals. I'm like, if I can endure this and get through these things.
Yep.
But I remember writing my exit interview letter. And then, you know, I had the VP of HR call me and just say, "Hope, this has been going on for how long?" I'm like, "Several years." Yeah. "And you never thought you could come tell me?" I'm like, "You golf with him on Saturday. You eat lunch with him every day. What were you going to do?" But I think they were very concerned that I was going to do something with what I had put in that letter. Yeah. And I just said, "Help it stop, because it's bad." And he, I honestly, I don't know. I think he just ended up retiring. So it got to go on. And I think as he got older, he got less horrible, but I think he was just tired. Yeah. But, you know, I look back on that to talk to HR.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
But I admire that you said that to them, because a lot of times, again, that's a moment of speaking truth to power. When the head of HR says, "But why didn't you come to me?" And you were able to give her a very concrete answer and to say, "As an employee, I know you golf with the guy on the weekends. I know that you go out for drinks together. I know that, like, you are buddy-buddy with this guy. Why in the world would I have felt safe with you?" And I bet, even if she's her own sort of horrible boss, I would bet she remembers that. And I hope that she applies that. And I hope that she has, at the very least, gone out of her way to say proactively to employees that I don't have an alliance to anyone in this institution. And so if somebody at the top is misbehaving, I need to know about it and I will take care of it. And I'm not friends with them. Like, I really hope she learned something from that. I really admire the fact that you told her the truth.
Well, thank you. And I tell people, even now when I'm doing individual leadership coaching, I'm like, if you see something or feel something, say something.
Hey, superintendents, school board members, principals, teachers, and educators of all kinds. Does your district or school have some room to grow? Or could things go a little better in your school or classroom? Would you like for your kids to learn more and have a more engaging time doing it? Feeling like you need a secret weapon to tackle everything from high quality instruction to robust professional development, maybe lesson planning or any other tricky challenges your school or classroom might have? We've got you covered at Educational Directions, celebrating 25 years of service in K-12 education. At Educational Directions, we're all about making your life easier. Want free tools to level up your teaching? Done. Looking for thought-provoking blogs full of fresh ideas? We've got those too. Need a customized program for your school's unique set of needs? We're the pros. Stop spinning your wheels and start winning in the classroom. Check us out at www.eddirections.com. That's eddirections.com. Educational Directions, your trusted partner in education. Always innovative and professional. Are you an artist struggling to bring your creative visions to life? Whether you're planning a multi-country tour, mounting a play at a local theater, or recording your first album, Before the Applause is here to guide you through every step of the way. Authored by industry experts Joe DeCenzi and Joe Hanna, this groundbreaking book offers artists the fundamentals of project management paired with leadership skills crucial to getting your artistic projects over the finish line. Unveiling Before the Applause, your ultimate guide to project management for artists.
So looking back, and you've mentioned some of the things that you did, you know, of going back and talking to people about this, but in these traumatic workplace situations, you know, maybe what is the one thing you feel like you really got right in responding to this? And what do you wish that you would have possibly done differently?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think I got it right at the medical university when I decided to sort of, quote, be a duck, to let things sort of run off my back, like sort of the water off a duck's back. I actually had somebody give me a little stuffed duckling and I had it in my office. Stuff would happen and I would feel my blood pressure rising and I would get really upset and angry. And I would just tell myself, be a duck, be a duck, be a duck. And so I decided, I knew once I got demoted that I had to get out of there. But I decided I was going to do it on my terms. They had forgotten to have me sign a non-disclosure agreement, and I knew all the details about all the scandals, including the ones that the reporters didn't know about yet. And there were a few. And so they knew that if I decided to talk to the media, they were up a creek. And so I laid low, I cashed my paycheck, and I went and got my MBA on my own dime. And I thought, if I don't, you know, I'm going to earn my seat at the table with the rest of the administrators of my next job. I think I also got it right by seeking mentors and allies beyond my reporting structure. So my boss was horrible and her boss was horrible. So I went to the chief operating officer of the university and said, I feel like I need mentorship. Would you be willing to have a meeting with me a couple times a month? And she reported directly to that tyrant president. She had come with him from his previous institution, so she knew him really well. And the day that I resigned, so they started protecting me. They moved me to their health system to run the marketing for the health systems. They took me out of the university structure, which helped. But the day that I resigned, the COO emailed me to say that she was unable to call me right now because she was so upset. She was in tears at her desk. And she said that she wishes she could have done more to protect me and that for the rest of her life, that this would have been one of her biggest personal career failures, was me leaving. Finding mentors and allies beyond your reporting structure, I think, is really important. At the business school, I got it right when I blew the whistle on the way out. And I also gave 6 months notice and then made them essentially said, I'm not leaving, I'm not writing you a letter. To say that I'm resigning until the university or the college signs on to be a client of my company. And so I sort of forced them to become a client. And so it got really ugly, but I took all of my power back at the end. And then they were just like, well, and I'm like, well, you can fire me if you want to and pay unemployment. I'm like, or you can let me like hire my replacement. And so I left on my terms and I never looked back, but I did get a lot wrong. I'm a pretty emotional person. I wear my emotions on my sleeve. I cry really easily. I cried too much at work. I wish I had a better ability to sort of, have a poker face. I think I let the fear and the humiliation get the better of me a lot of the time. I lost the ability to say, I'm great, when I'd be walking down the hall and bump into a colleague and they'd say, hey, how you doing? Or how you doing today? I would say things like, well, I haven't killed anybody today. So there's that, and so that bitterness was showing. But I was stuck. I needed to pay the bills. I didn't know what else to do. And in a lot of these situations, I was really young. When I was at the medical university, I was the youngest person in an administrative role at the entire university. So, I had a ton of responsibility and zero power. I know now that I was doing the best that I could with the tools and the resources that I had. And I would say for anybody listening today who is in a really tough spot like this, you can only do what you can do. And if you are backed into a corner or you don't have a lot of tools or resources, you don't have a coach, you don't have a mentor, you're doing the best that you can, and that's okay. I would say that looking back, the thing that I got truly right and that I am most proud of is that I always protected my employees from the tyrants. I took all of the bullets for them. I would never let my employees go into an office alone with one of these tyrants. I sometimes physically stepped between them and these tyrants. And decades later, my direct reports from those jobs are now close personal friends. So I hope they understand just a little bit what I endured and how hard I worked every single day to keep them out of the line of fire.
Well, and that's being so respectful, because I've also worked for people that the bad boss was one above us and the one in the middle was just like, well, I'm not getting protected, so I'm not going to protect you. So it's just like, wow, what you're hating, you're putting more of that out there. Yeah. So not everybody has the courage to be able to do that. So I greatly admire and respect that. So you mentioned like there's a couple of practical things, but is there any other practical skills or tools that you would recommend to our listeners out there that if they're currently in the situation, they've been in the situation, or just guarding yourself, preparing yourself for the potential? We've said there's less of these out there, but they're still out there running live. So what might be some things you would recommend?
I think there are a few really practical things. So first of all, nervous system regulation. So deep breathing, meditation, kind of a commitment to radical acceptance of being like, this guy or this gal is crazy, and that's not my fault. I come from a Celtic background, and so we've got this sort of Irish proverb that a lot of people know, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And knowing how to let go in the moment of the stuff that is not you, like to be able to look at that tyrant and think in your head, this is a you problem, buddy. This is not a me problem. And, but the nervous system, the body really does keep the score. And so doing meditation, breathing, brain retraining, whatever you want to do to keep your body, because otherwise you'll get sick. I have a lot of health issues today that I guarantee I would not have had I not gone through these experiences. I mentioned having allies and mentors outside of your reporting structure. I think that's really critical. Go find them and say, I'm looking for a mentor. Like, say that. I think you need perspective. Again, remember, it's not about you. Can you learn to laugh about the crazy tyrant boss? Sort of like a school teacher, who had a kid, throw an X-Acto knife at them or whatever, and that they can go home and laugh about it when they talk about it with their spouse. How do you learn to survive by learning to laugh about it? I definitely think you need an exit plan. That might require getting more education or credentials or networking, going to conferences, sort of being known, being seen. Do that work. I also wish I had known that I needed to go home on time and take my weekends. Because throwing yourself into a job where the leadership is abusing you is in the end masochistic, and you just deserve so much better than that. And I would say in the end, don't carry the shame for someone else's misbehaviors. You can choose not to carry it.
That is excellent advice. Excellent advice. So I do have a question here. How do these people get to be to the C-suite? There are people skills are just
Atrocious.
They're, I was going to say gross. Yep. They're disappointing. They're ugly. So how do they get there?
I mean, so there's a, it's universal, I think, in any industry. So functional expertise, if you're a really good accountant, you're a really good engineer, you're a really good marketer, you're good at the job itself, will get you in, and then you keep rising, right? And having really unique skills. So if you're the only person in the building, you know, or the only person, you know, you live that you're the only person who has a certain licensure or knows how to work these machines at the factory in a 50-mile radius, well, you're going to get the job and you might continue to rise. I think people who have a lot of tenure and institutional knowledge, right? So people who just stick it out and stay in organizations, even if they don't have really good people skills, and maybe even if they're not even that good at their job. But at some point, you know, you're saying, oh, well, but, you know, Susie is, you know, she's been here for 25 years and she's the only person who really understands how this works with our customers. She's going to get promoted to COO, even if she's a horrible boss, right? Because she sort of knows where the bodies are buried. I think people with a lot of confidence make it to the C-suite, even if they're tyrants, right? They show up with the perfect outfit. They say all the right things. Some of them having really great connections. So
they know how to play politics.
They know how to, they're very, very sort of diplomatic and political. A lot of people have great connections, right? So when you know somebody who's on the board of an organization where you want to get a leadership position, it's a lot easier to come in at a high level when you're connected. This is a weird one, and this one frustrated me, and I'll never forget asking the COO at the medical university this question. I said, you know, I got tormented for catching a virus and going homesick. And I said, do people only make it to the top in organizations? And if in a Darwinian way, like if you're just lucky enough to never get sick, you know, as is a health and good looks, survival of the fittest sort of thing. And she said, yeah, probably. And as somebody who has a really serious chronic illness and that creates dynamic disability, it's very frustrating to me to know that people, you know, who just sort of got good genetics and stuff sometimes make it to the top because they look leaderly, right? People will often say, oh, she's very presidential, right? And what do they mean by that? They mean the pearl necklace looks really great with that suit, or what does that mean? So I also think that a lot of people who are horrible bosses make it to the C-suite because they're willing to be the bad guy. And when you are trying to create institutional change at an organization, sometimes you want to hire somebody who will get a lot of stuff done. But at what cost? At what cost to the people and at what cost to the culture? So, yeah, I think there are a lot of reasons why people make it to the C-suite with horrible people skills.
Well, and you know, I have engaged in this conversation a number of times with COOs, with VPs of HR, even with CEOs, when they will have a very, very bad boss, managerial terrorist, whatever you want to call it. They'll say, well, we can't let so-and-so go because they have that institutional knowledge and they've been here for a really long time.
Yep.
And my question back is always, what is it costing you for them to stay?
So we did an exercise once when I was at the business school. We had a speaker come in who had written a best-selling book, and he actually had us do an exercise. We had every employee of the institution. And so they said, we want you to think about a person you have trouble with, interpersonal issues with in the institution, and take out a sheet of paper. And I want you, and they actually walked us through this exercise where we essentially guessed at how much money we thought this person's salary was. And then we did the math to figure out what does that come out to in an hour. And then we had to think about how many times did we like try to work around them, sort of circumvent problems with them, do things the harder way, bring on a consultant instead of getting things done with a person inside, and try to figure out how many hours did we waste trying to avoid these interpersonal issues with this problem person and quantify that. And then we all sort of raised our hands and said, the person that I have trouble with, I think has cost the institution X number of dollars. And it was shocking. I mean, we were eventually, once everybody was raising their hands, we were talking about millions of dollars that were being wasted because they wouldn't fire the bad guys, right? And so, yeah, I think you make a really excellent point.
And they were only looking at the short-term pain.
Yep. Right.
And it's like, let's look at the long-term cost because you're going to lose people. And, you know, I've said this time and time again, it's not the people that quit and leave you have to worry about, it's the people that quit and stay.
Yes.
And there are going to be people working for people like this that are quitting and staying and sabotaging things, not because they're bad people, but it's because we are putting them into a bad situation. And right, like even in your own situation, you couldn't, it's not something I could just walk away. There are a lot of people walking away from jobs today. I have friends that have no job lined up. They said they didn't care. They would go, you know, they would go do whatever, work at the mall until they could figure out something, because it was just an unhealthy, very unhealthy situation. So it's, so what, where does the lingering trauma of this managerial terrorism for you still rear its ugly head? Because I know for me, it does. I mean, I can be in a similar situation and feel like it's headed for the same thing, even though I'm now in consulting, and it's because the scars 100%. Run deep and I've had therapy over it, and I still own a lot of it and look back and was like, what did I do to deserve this? And I'm like, whoa, no, wait a minute. No, I did not. But
I mean, this is still the thing. That's why I love that we're having this conversation, because I think that people are going to be validated by hearing this, because I mean, listen, I haven't had a boss in 13 years was when I left that last job and, threw myself into running my own businesses. And, but to this day, if a client says, can we talk, or sends a weird cryptic text, right? My heart starts to race. Your husband and I, had a little bit of an altercation on a project, and I was like, oh my God, he's pissed off at me. And like, I felt sick. Like felt physically sick. If somebody raises their voice at me or gets a little red in the face, I sometimes really shrink. But I would say that I shrink only for a moment, and literally within 30 to 60 seconds, like I have it back together. So I'm pretty good these days, I think, at taking a slow, deep breath and realizing this is not about me. They've got their own stuff to contend with. This is just business. Let me understand why they're upset. Let me try to understand how to get to a place where we're all really happy with the results. So I think I'm pretty good at turning an angry colleague into a happy one. And I do that by making eye contact and validating their position, even if I disagree with it, and offering to help them in whatever ways are reasonable, not whatever ways are possible. I used to do things as quick as possible, as soon as possible. I do things now as soon as reasonable, because I have more respect for myself. But you're 100% right, Hope. I mean, listen, I'm 51 years old, and sometimes I still feel like a kid that just got caught with their hand in the cookie jar, right? Like where, if I'm confronted by one of these sort of managerial terrorist types, I think the nervous system never really forgets. Just as if you went through any sort of trauma when you were younger, whether it was you're a combat veteran and a car backfires, or you were, in an abusive relationship and somebody raises their voice at you now. I don't have any bosses now. I've got clients and partners and collaborators. And I think taking back my control when I quit that last job went a long way toward healing my wounds, but it's still there. But the fact that I can talk about it today and laugh about some of it and not feel it rising up in my body in the way that I used to means that I've come a long way, but it took decades.
It does. And, I'm sitting here thinking of two particular incidents in school, because I think, bad teachers, it starts young age, these people that we respect, that we think are there to mentor us, to
teach us, teachers, babysitters.
And I mean, the first one was fourth grade, having a teacher tell me that I was stupid in math in front of the entire class. To this day, I still struggle slowly with math in my head, and it's funny because my niece Hazel was like, you're good with math, Hopie. I'm like, not as good as I could have been. and then the second one was singing in the choir. I had a teacher ask me if I was singing. We were singing, I don't even know what song it was. And she specifically said to me, Hope, are you singing? And I said, I am. And I thought, oh my God, here it comes. My solo. She said, don't sing this next round. And then after I did not, she said, that is so much better. And so, when I was thinking about your stuff, I'm like, my bad boss situation triggers back all the way to, of these people that I so wanted approval from.
Yeah.
And, I don't think it changes as adults. These people that are above us, that we want to respect, that we, we feel like should care about us, should nurture us, should take care of us. I mean, and that's what I would say. I'm not sure how many bad bosses or manager or terrorists we're going to have listening, but I hope maybe if we do have some that go, oh, could you be? Maybe I could be.
Yeah.
Is that you understand the power of influence that you hold on people.
Yeah.
Because and by you the way, can inflict permanent pain.
Yeah. And I do think that people, I said, listen, I've probably been a bad boss. I can think of some things I've really done wrong. And But I do think that you know, people can change. You know, we have an author we worked with here at the publishing company that I own, Eric Williamson, who wrote a book called How to Work with Jerks, Getting Shit Done with People You Can't Stand.
What a great title.
I know. Yeah, it's a great title. And, you know, and he admits in that book that he used to be a jerk in the workplace. And so I think that we are all capable with appropriate reflection and, you know, emotional intelligence. I do think we can activate that in ourselves and we can be better, right? That whole, you know, Maya Angelou, when you know better, you can do better. And I think that some of us were not given any sort of training. When I think about when I reported to people who were doctors or, you know, they were experts at what they did, but why in the world would we think a neurologist would be a really great leader? Right? Like, he doesn't have an MBA. He didn't have, nobody taught him, you know.
They don't teach leadership skills in medical
school. They're not, right? You know, they're barely teaching bedside manner, you know. But interestingly, when you're talking about teachers, I actually think the healthcare industry ends up sort of replacing that for us when we become adults, right? So then we all get white coat syndrome. We go see a doctor, and if they're dismissive with us, they're abrupt, we ask a question about a symptom, they're like, no, that's not true. We sometimes feel that tension coming up in our body again, where we think, oh my gosh, this is a person in power. But I always remind myself, I have several graduate degrees, and like you, like, I don't, my doctors don't have more education than I do. They just happen to specialize in something else, right? I'm really good at what I do. They're really good at what I do. I went to a doctor once and she was doing some things to my body that were really painful. And her name was Rose. And I'm like, Rose, I thought we were friends. Like, please stop. And I was like teasing. And she said, my patients don't typically call me Rose. And I said, well, when you walked in the room, you called me Kate. And she just shut up. but you're absolutely right. Listen, my mother is 77 years old, and you can see the emotion in her when she tells stories about teachers who were cruel to her when she was a little girl. Like, this stuff never goes away.
It doesn't.
We get better at carrying it. And hopefully we learn to really sort of let it go and laugh about it. But it can take a lot of work. It can take a lot of therapy. I think therapists have made a lot of money off of those of us who have had managerial terrorist bosses.
I agree. Well, it's when you were talking about crying, I was an emotional crier too. I mean, ENFJ and personality on Myers-Briggs, my F has gotten, I have modified my behavior more towards the T in life, getting older and having to for what I do for business. And I've got to have a stronger backbone with things, but I'll never forget being brought into a boss's office. And he looked at me and he gave me some pretty, in my opinion, harsh feedback. And I could feel the tears just beginning to fall down my face. And he said, you are not going to get up out of here and be crying. He's like, I don't care what you got to do. I don't care if you sit here for an hour. He said, you do not leave this office crying. That is not management. And so I don't know how in the heck I pulled it together. I was in my early 30s.
Oh, but that's interesting. But do you look back? And I want to stop you for a second. When you look back on that, though, do you realize that that was him not wanting to be embarrassed? And because if you walked out of his office 100%. Crying and people saw that, they knew that that was on him. That was gaslighting. He tried to make it out like it made you look like a bad leader if you were crying, when ultimately it made him look like a bad leader if you left his office.
And in retrospect and therapy, I got there.
Yeah.
But in that moment, I just remember I walked out of there and I ran so fast to the bathroom that was like the other side of the building. I looked under each stall and I just was like, I was just like, why am I feeling this way? And, you know, like you, I'm so much stronger now. And all of these things have continued to make me stronger. But, you know, what I want our listeners to understand is, you know, and even therapists say this, I'm not making this go away for you. I am helping you. And I don't like to use the word cope anymore because it just sounds, I'm going to help you integrate this story, this part of your life into your life.
Yeah.
And how do you channel that? So as you said, maybe for 30 seconds, it's a trigger. You get flashed back into a Michael Peter situation. And then you're like, whoa, come back to it.
Yeah.
It's different because I'm different. I now have the tools to carry this. And I know that this is a lot more about you than me. And I can take it. I still don't like it. I still think it's inappropriate.
Right.
But now I know this isn't all me. You know, this isn't, I may have done something.
You know your worth.
I know my worth. I know my worth. Well, I would love to ask you is, you know, before we let listeners where they can find Kate and interact with you if they want to, and if, you know, if they're trying to write books too, you're doing publishing. There's so many amazing things that you do. You are just multi-talented. I have so much respect. And as you said, you're doing this often when you're not feeling 100%. You know, you've got battles and other things, but I think also you've channeled so much of that into your work as well. And I think that's, you know, really, really helped you. And I have so much respect for you. I really do. So what would be your best piece of advice for the leaders listening who have worked for bad bosses or are currently working for them to activate hope and become their best selves despite the trauma?
I mean, first of all, they need to know that there is hope. And, you know, you won't always work for that tyrant, but they'll probably always be miserable. And, you know, I would say take heart in knowing that you are better than the vitriol that they're spewing. I believe strongly, we talked about this, about never wasting a crisis. So, you know, I believe in learning and applying lessons from the hardest moments of our lives and careers. So I encourage people who are working for a bad boss to get out a fresh notebook and start working on a plan for healing and escape. Like literally start writing this stuff down. So is there a way to be known and be seen in your industry by going to the right conferences or writing a book or getting a graduate degree or knowing the right people or taking the right people out to coffee? I would think of this as a project, sort of project me. And if you task yourself with project me being your most important project and you start sketching out step-by-step plans for how to rise above the garbage you've been put through, you can. Because here's the thing, someday you're going to be wildly successful and those horrible bosses are going to be unemployed or retired or dead. And you're going to be talking about them, maybe on a podcast, right? Not with fear and trepidation in your voice, but with the confidence of, can you believe this nonsense? So, you know, nobody was there with me when I was being terrorized by horrible bosses. Nobody of those people who were there with me thought that the horrible bosses got it right. Like nobody's looking back. Anybody who witnessed the Michael experiences or the Peter experience, nobody's looking back and being like, oh yeah, Kate, she was a real loser. Like that guy was right. I know for sure none of them are. They know that I survived terrible treatment. I think many of them admire how that I've refused to let that keep me down. So, you know, what's that they say about the best revenge being, you know, wild success? I think it is. And for what it's worth, I think anger, interestingly, is more empowering a space to be in than despair. So while I don't encourage you to sort of match your angry boss's anger, I would say go ahead and be angry if that helps you to maintain your power and your hope. And just know it is up to you to rise above. And the shame of this behavior is theirs, not yours.
That is beautiful advice. And, you know, I'm sitting here thinking of your Michael and Peter, and mine is a Tony John, and no, I'm not changing their names, but I've often thought if I were to run into them today, I would give them a hug and I would say, thank you. Because I just celebrated 15 years of a leadership development company, teaching people what not to do. So yeah. Thank you. You know, yeah. I mean, really, it just channeling it that way, instead of true. Holding on to it's the bitterness true. Of it, I had to go through that to do what I do.
I do believe, I mean, listen, I learned a lot from great bosses and I've had some really good ones. And I learned a lot in classrooms when I was getting my MBA in organizational behavior and whatnot. But I think you're 100% right. We learn at least as much from the bad experiences and from the bad bosses as we do from the good ones. And if we are decent human beings, we're going to look at that and say, how can I never be like that? How can I be a better boss to the people? How can I be a better service provider to my clients? How can I be a better human being, a better neighbor, a better spouse, a better friend, a better sister? And I really do believe sort of like going through boot camp sort of strips you down and then lets you be built up to a different kind of leader. I do think that we got battle tested by these experiences. And while I wish they'd never happened to me, I really wish they'd never happened to me. I do know that they made me stronger in some ways in the end. And I hope that the people listening know that their strength is theirs to seize and to wield.
Well, you are out there shining your beautiful light. And as you said, that is the sweetest revenge, is just shining brighter as a result of what we've been through. 100%. Well, I can't thank you enough. I was looking so forward to this conversation and just to, you know, have my own to be able to like compare stories of, you know, what we've done to get through this together. Exactly. So if people would love to continue this conversation with you, or really if they have aspirations of possibly writing a book about their traumatic experience of working for bad bosses. What is the best way for them to get in contact with you?
So first of all, I've always said I was going to write an anthology called Horrible Bosses and find people who've had horrible bosses, and we could all like write our own chapters. So that is something I would be willing to talk to folks about. But you can find my book, Think Like a Marketer, How a Shift in Mindset Can Change Everything for Your Business, at thinklikeamarketerthebook.com. And if you happen to work in higher ed and enjoyed my higher ed stories today, my most recent book is entitled Commencement, The Beginning of a New Era in Higher Education. It's available at commencementthebook.com. And you can find me on LinkedIn simply as Kate Colbert, and I welcome the connection.
Well, thank you, Kate. It has, like I said, it has been a pleasure. I don't know about you. I feel better.
This was very cathartic.
It was very cathartic for a podcast. So I hope our listeners feel the catharsis that you and I felt today, because I just know, and you and I both know, working with people, you know, even your writers, your authors, we've all gone through some of this. So I think a lot of the healing also comes in the being able to share and talk about it. And how do we move a path forward?
It really does. We're not accountable for the swamp, but we can be a duck.
We can be a duck. I love it. Let it roll. Let it roll. Well, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. And I know I will be seeing you soon.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. Now go activate your hope. And we look forward to seeing you next time.